If the merchant wants the Bitcoin and you pay in fiat, that is you shifting the burden of fiat friction onto them. And paying your value to vendors in Bitcoin is the opposite of mutually assured destruction. It's mutually assured survival. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have got a wonderful read. We have Parker Lewis back on the saddle doing some writing, and I know his book and lots of really, really cool things are happening with the Gradually Then Suddenly series, which I absolutely love. And anybody who knows, all of the audio is available on this podcast. I will be linking to the first piece. I think there's like 15 of them or something. I'll be linking to the first piece in the show notes. And maybe I should take this opportunity to kind of put them all together somewhere. I'll see if Parker is linking to the audio on the actual articles, because I also have the link to the Gradually Then Suddenly website where you can find all the written versions. Actually, you know what I'll do in the meantime, just in case? I will make a Spotify playlist. That is a really easy way to get the link. So that's probably what you should see in the show notes instead. A Spotify playlist with a link to the Gradually Then Suddenly series by Parker Lewis. But anyway, we've got a different one today, and it's based off, or it's the same theory or the same theme, I guess, as the BitBlock Boom speech that he gave, the presentation that he gave. And it's a really interesting way to think about merchant adoption in Bitcoin and how we're moving from the store of value to the medium of exchange phase, and why there's not actually a chicken and egg problem here, that there's fundamentally an order of operations or order of events from the concept of how the merchant sees or understands the value of Bitcoin, or how all of the individuals in Bitcoin see and understand its value before there is actual reason and widespread adoption for accepting it as a means of payment. So anyway, I won't head off the article too much. We will go ahead and get right into it. This episode is brought to you by Nodeless. Nodeless.io/guy is my special link. And this is the easiest way. No setup. Don't set up a node. Don't worry about BTC Pay server. This is the easiest way to get all that functionality, to get it plugged into your WooCommerce store, get a donation page, set up a fundraiser, accept it on your website or for your project, set up paywalls, whatever it is, you know, even design simple webhooks with none of the Bitcoin or Lightning overhead. Nodeless does all the work, and you just get the Bitcoin forwarded directly to you. There's no subscription here. It is a simple 1% plus 100 sat fee. Signing up doesn't cost anything. There's no KYC. This is literally the perfect way to get the person who you know is interested in Bitcoin but has yet to accept it or doesn't really know how to deal with, you know, running a node or doing any of that stuff. How do they get plugged into Bitcoin? How do they easily accept it? That is what Nodeless is for, to make the entire process as painless and simple as possible. And right now I'm offering, don't know how long I'm going to keep this up, I'm offering, if you go to my link right in the show notes, set up your donation page, literally takes a couple of clicks, and tag me on Nostr or Twitter with the link, I will throw you 10,000 sats. So check it out. It's nice to have 10,000 sats. And you should put those sats on your cold card hardware wallet, which you will also get a 9% discount for with code Bitcoin Audible. You know, if you want to keep your Bitcoin safe, you need a cold card. Check them out. All the details are available in the show notes. And with that, let's get into today's read. And it's titled, Pay Me in Bitcoin Theory by Parker Lewis. Pay me in Bitcoin is singular, not circular. All you can control is your business. Today, Bitcoin is used predominantly as a long-term store of value. What I put forward is that Bitcoin will transition from an exceptional store of value, albeit volatile and a bit clunky, to a currency used day-to-day that facilitates trade directly for goods and services. and that ultimately virtually all goods and services in the world will be both priced in Bitcoin and traded in Bitcoin. Bitcoin's end game is a price system, and the following is how I see the transition beginning. The pay me in Bitcoin theory of Bitcoin payments summarized. Someone must understand why Bitcoin stores value to want to be paid in it. Receiving Bitcoin payments is a balance sheet decision at the end of the day. Merchants will drive the shift to Bitcoin payments for this reason, specifically merchants who understand why Bitcoin stores value. Business owners are ultimately in control of what currency to accept. Spending Bitcoin can be both rational and irrational for consumers. Spending Bitcoin is rational if the merchant is valued and saves in Bitcoin. Accepting Bitcoin payments does not mean not accepting fiat payments, and the transition to payments will be gradual, similar to saving in Bitcoin. End game. Store of value to unit of account. A price system. A few weeks ago at BitBlock Boom, I gave a presentation explaining that the end game of Bitcoin is as a price system. Over time, Bitcoin will transition from a nascent and niche store of value that is predominantly exchanged for fiat currencies to a transactional currency facilitating direct commerce for goods and services. Ultimately, the price of all goods will be denominated in Bitcoin, and trade will be affected directly in Bitcoin, rather than through fiat currencies as indirect intermediaries. To quickly catch everyone here up, the logic is as follows. Bitcoin effectively stores value over time because it has a fixed supply. There are two economic principles that I believe are true, in an objective sense. Both would need to be accepted as true in order for the rest of the logic to follow. First, economic systems converge on a single form of money due to the intersubjective problem of trade, i.e., I must have the form of money you are willing to accept for us to trade, and vice versa, which extends to the next person and the next, and ultimately to everyone in the world. And second, economic systems naturally converge on the scarcest form of money. People would rather be paid in a form of money that cannot be printed than in a form of money that can easily be printed, because the former will more effectively store value between exchanges. Download Bitcoin Obsoletes All Other Money for more on these principles. In short, everything is tied to Bitcoin's fixed supply of 21 million. If Bitcoin's fixed supply is credibly enforced, then Bitcoin translates to a form of money that cannot be printed at all, i.e., the scarcest form of money. If Bitcoin stores value over time due to its fixed supply, people will naturally want to conduct trade for goods and services directly in exchange for Bitcoin. People will demand to be paid in the form of money that best stores value, rather than inferior forms of money. And a finitely scarce form of money will store value better than any other form of money. If Bitcoin is used to facilitate trade directly for goods and services, that trade will naturally become denominated in Bitcoin over time. So all in, if Bitcoin credibly enforces its fixed supply, it will not just be a store of value, but instead, Bitcoin will inevitably be used to facilitate trade directly and will become the unit of account. At the end of the day, this will mean food at the grocery store, gas at the gas station, your power and water bills, healthcare, real estate, etc., all being priced in some denomination of Bitcoin and paid for directly in Bitcoin. But how would, or could, the world logically transition from where it is today with very few Bitcoin payments to that end state where practically everything is priced and traded in Bitcoin? Order of operations. In my experience, this is not a chicken and egg dilemma as to which comes first. There's a logical order. Humans first must reasonably expect a good to store value over some time horizon in order to trade their finitely scarce time, which translates to the output of their labor, in return. At this early stage of Bitcoin adoption, for someone to want to be paid in Bitcoin, it is logical that they must first have some reason to expect Bitcoin will store value. While most people in the world might get their first Bitcoin by being paid in Bitcoin when all is said and done, it is far easier today to buy some Bitcoin through an exchange for fiat currencies than it is to set up to get paid in Bitcoin. The logical progression is for someone to begin saving in Bitcoin by buying it, the path of least resistance, gain a better understanding of why Bitcoin stores value, and once Bitcoin begins to become intuitive as money, Then and thereafter, someone begins to think about accepting Bitcoin payments directly. For this reason, it is also logical that merchants, rather than consumers, will drive the shift to Bitcoin payments. Built into this logic is the recognition that the fundamental decision to accept Bitcoin as payment for goods and services, as a business or contractor, is more of a balance sheet decision as an input, i.e. one of savings, than it is a decision about a method of payment. I fully accept that some merchants will accept Bitcoin as a method of payment to more efficiently get back to a fiat currency. But even accepting this, I still maintain that its use as a method of payment cannot be divorced from its ability to store value, nor will such demand be sustained in the long term due to the very same reason that fiat currencies are failing, i.e. due to their inability to store value. The decision to accept Bitcoin as payment directly for goods and services is the same economic calculus as exchanging Bitcoin for fiat at a Bitcoin exchange or brokerage firm. Once an individual figures out that Bitcoin will store value and why, the idea logically follows that accepting Bitcoin as payment is the same as buying Bitcoin. It is just a different path to the same end of getting Bitcoin in a business treasury or on a balance sheet, personal or business. Accepting Bitcoin as payment is a balance sheet decision. If you are not a Bitcoin miner, i.e. most people, there are only two ways to acquire Bitcoin. Get paid in a fiat currency and convert it to Bitcoin with a Bitcoin exchange, or be paid directly in Bitcoin by customers. When I say that accepting Bitcoin as payment is a balance sheet decision, it's because the economic calculus is tied to Bitcoin's ability to store value, just the same as if one were to consider buying it. If Bitcoin stores value over time, you will logically pursue both, buying Bitcoin and accepting Bitcoin as payment for goods and services. If Bitcoin does not store value over time, you will logically pursue neither. Similarly, if you decide to personally save in Bitcoin because it effectively stores value, you also logically come to the conclusion that your business, if you run a business, should hold Bitcoin on its balance sheet. The calculus from individual to business is the same, just as it is whether to hold Bitcoin at all. The only difference is how to acquire the Bitcoin. Whether you exchange your time and goods or services for fiat and then acquire Bitcoin, or whether you just go direct and cut out the middleman, directly trading goods and services for Bitcoin. I also accept that people gamble or speculate in Bitcoin, simply trying to make more fiat money and have no idea the fundamental reason to demand Bitcoin is because it's a better form of money. It does not change the fundamental reason why there is a market for Bitcoin in the first place. Two things can be true at the same time. Degenerates and professional investors can gamble on Bitcoin trying to make more fiat money, while at the same time it remains true that all long-term demand for Bitcoin derives from its use as money, namely its ability to store value over time and facilitate trade. On a fundamental level, once someone determines that Bitcoin will store value, it becomes logical to acquire the Bitcoin as efficiently as possible. While the economic calculus is the same, receiving Bitcoin payments is a more direct and efficient path than moving money through the fiat system only to then acquire Bitcoin, if you want the Bitcoin. In essence, the rationale is the same economically, but the two rails are fundamentally different. As an individual or merchant, once you know you want to save in Bitcoin, it becomes very logical why you would want to cut out an entirely different currency as an intermediary and in an end state. While it becomes logical and ultimately a more efficient path to acquire Bitcoin, that doesn't mean that it's magically easier to accept Bitcoin payments than fiat payments. If you are already set up to receive fiat payments and buy Bitcoin, investing in infrastructure to receive Bitcoin payments will require work, which means more work by definition. And without a doubt, there is friction beyond just getting set up to receive Bitcoin as payment as a business or contractor, particularly for tax and accounting reasons. However, it becomes logical nonetheless, despite the perception of greater friction on the surface. If Bitcoin acts as a better store of value, everything follows from that point. There is a lot of friction in the fiat system. It also happens to be difficult to see and hard to quantify. The centralized rails and choke points create risk. The holds on money and chargebacks create risk. The solvency or insolvency of banks as rails create risk. The devaluation of the currency, which happens to be accelerating, is the greatest source of risk and friction of the fiat system. The costs are everywhere and add up. Today, most people might not feel or observe it day to day, but the risks are there nonetheless. The risks are also becoming more observable as time passes to more people, and particularly for those who have already figured out why Bitcoin stores value and why fiat currencies do the opposite. Ultimately, those people either wait for the fiat system to deteriorate to the point when it no longer functionally works before starting to receive Bitcoin payments, or they create a redundancy well in advance. The latter is the only logical move for someone who has already come to the conclusion that Bitcoin is a superior form of money. The only question is when one decides to act, which is dependent on the nature of one's business or employment and the perception of the relative friction. Merchants will logically drive the shift to Bitcoin payments. Not everyone has equal ability or power to start being paid in Bitcoin. That should go without saying. An employee at a large corporation has little power to dictate to a large employer to pay them in Bitcoin. Not dissimilarly, a small business owner might not have customers willing or able to pay in Bitcoin, which necessarily factors into the perception of friction. However, while this may be true, the incentive to receive Bitcoin as payment directly for goods and services remains all the same, and it's pulling everyone who has figured out why Bitcoin is a superior form of money to that point like a gravitational force. In practically all cases, this shift will be driven by the merchant rather than the consumer, principally for the fundamental reason that it's a balance sheet decision more than anything else. Consumer-driven. Can I pay you in Bitcoin? Please accept Bitcoin as payment because I want to pay you in Bitcoin, and you should save in Bitcoin because it's a better form of money. Merchant-driven. Pay me in Bitcoin. Please pay me in Bitcoin because I prefer Bitcoin because it's a better form of money. The merchant is the one ultimately in control of the decision, and the merchant is also the one that must invest in the infrastructure. There is greater upfront friction in getting setting up to accept Bitcoin as payment than not, almost by definition. The only way a merchant, i.e. a business owner, rationally does that is if he or she, or collectively a board or management team, understands why Bitcoin is a better form of money and that by accepting Bitcoin as payment, the business is reducing a less obvious source of friction or eliminating a long-term risk. The key word is long-term. Businesses plan for the long term. The rational decision to accept Bitcoin payments doesn't happen because a consumer wants to pay a business that doesn't understand Bitcoin in Bitcoin. It happens because an individual or individuals running a business have figured out why Bitcoin is a better form of money and that it is in their long-term interest to do so. Rationality and irrationality of spending Bitcoin. If a business wants fiat money, for example, dollars, and a consumer has the same fiat money, it would make far more sense for an individual to just pay in fiat currency than it would to pay in Bitcoin and for the merchant to then convert to fiat in almost all cases. Yes, there are edge cases, but if the merchant wants to be paid in the same fiat currency you hold, and the merchant is not going to save in Bitcoin, it would be irrational to introduce greater friction to the buyer, the individual, and seller, merchant, if the seller just wants fiat money. Now, if the merchant wants the Bitcoin and the individual has Bitcoin, Bitcoin as a method of payment becomes rational for both parties. Set aside how one might know the merchant wants Bitcoin for now, for example, a Bitcoin preferred message or charging a premium if someone wants to pay in US dollars rather than Bitcoin. If a merchant asks to be paid in Bitcoin, the individual, if a Bitcoiner, will pay in Bitcoin, overwhelmingly in most cases, and despite the tax and accounting friction, which are the primary sources of friction when paying in Bitcoin. If you don't believe me that Bitcoiners will pay a merchant business run by a Bitcoiner, loosely defined as someone who understands why Bitcoin is a superior form of money, in Bitcoin, try it and see, in practice. The reason Bitcoiners would pay in Bitcoin is rooted in reason and logic, just the same as why a Bitcoiner would not pay in Bitcoin if a business were just going to convert it to fiat. In the process of completing the transaction, method of payment, there is less friction for the buyer when paying in Bitcoin. All of the practical friction to a Bitcoin payment from a buyer's perspective exists in the fiat accounting and tax consequence. But if a business says, pay me in Bitcoin, and actually wants the Bitcoiner is put in an ethical dilemma. The Bitcoiner knows that Bitcoin is a better form of money and why the merchant would want to receive it. Choosing to pay a merchant that wants Bitcoin but accepts fiat in fiat is a conscious decision to pay in a form of money that is losing value, which carries with it some inherent dishonesty. Not only is it disrespectful and against the merchant's wishes, but the Bitcoiner knows there is something wrong about paying a merchant in fiat that actually wants Bitcoin. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Again, if you do not believe me, put a Bitcoiner in this position and see what happens. So part of the rationality is in doing what is right by a merchant that the consumer values. One could view this as altruistic and come away with doubts, but the second part of rationality is actually rooted in selfish reasons. An individual has a direct incentive to ensure a critical vendor remains in business. If, one, you value a business, and two, your business asks to be paid in a form of money that will A, better store value, and B, will help them continue to do just what you want to deliver value to you, selfishly, are you going to pay them in Bitcoin, or would you shift the burden of fiat friction back onto them? See, if the business wants the Bitcoin and you pay in fiat, the merchant has to pay all the processing fees of the fiat system while also being subject to holds on the money to reduce risk of chargebacks, only to then convert the fiat to Bitcoin, which comes with more fees. If the merchant wants the Bitcoin and you pay in fiat, that is you shifting the burden of fiat friction onto them. And paying your valued vendors in Bitcoin is the opposite of mutually assured destruction. It's mutually assured survival. This is what I think about each time I pay my rancher for beef in Bitcoin. I don't do it for the novelty. I do it part out of mutual respect, part out of value for value ethos, not paying for something of value in a form of money that I know to be losing its value. And in the long term, most importantly, because I want that guy to be around selling me quality beef. And I know he's going to be in a better position to do that with Bitcoin. If he wants Bitcoin, I'll pay him in Bitcoin because I want him to be around tomorrow, the next day, and the months and years to come. I know he has working capital and treasury management needs. Inevitably, he must sell and buy Bitcoin from time to time to manage his treasury. But he's a Bitcoiner and he wants to be paid in Bitcoin, and I know why. This analog applies to every business you value, and especially those run by Bitcoiners. If you know a business to be run by Bitcoiners and they ask you to pay in Bitcoin, you have a rational and selfish reason to pay them in Bitcoin. It doesn't change the fact that it is also perfectly rational to help a critical vendor, that you want to be around for the long term, understand Bitcoin from zero to one. But buy that vendor the Bitcoin standard and help them first understand why Bitcoin stores value over time. There is no path or shortcut around that. A merchant must first logically understand why he or she would want to save in Bitcoin before demanding it directly in exchange for goods and services. The merchant who understands Bitcoin will unavoidably and inevitably drive the shift to Bitcoin payments because both parties to the exchange must understand the value and incentives for it to be rational, and conversely, why it's actually not irrational and not just another hurdle or source of greater friction. Transition rather than all at once. One thing that often trips up academic economists, central bankers, and Wall Street finance types alike is understanding how Bitcoin could be at the same time incredibly volatile and a superior form of money. That would seem to be a contradictory statement on the surface. However, the better question to ask is, why does volatility not prevent adoption of Bitcoin as money? The principal reason is that it is not an all-or-nothing dilemma. Bitcoin does not exist in a vacuum. When people first begin to save in Bitcoin, it is typically with a limited understanding, and as a result, they allocate a small percentage of their savings, for example, 1 to 5% of liquid assets. The volatility of Bitcoin is effectively muted and offset by exposure to other less volatile assets, allowing each person to benefit from saving in a superior store of value that happens to also be more volatile. This concept that saving in Bitcoin is not all or nothing is logically why Bitcoin's volatility does not prevent adoption as money or as a store of value. The same applies to payments. Deciding to accept Bitcoin as payment is not all or nothing. Getting infrastructure set up to accept Bitcoin payments does not mean abandoning all fiat rails as part of the same logical decision. Humans are rational. Accepting Bitcoin payments does not mean turning off fiat payments. It means a business giving its customers an option to pay in Bitcoin and investing in the infrastructure to be able to do so before a time when there is no other option. Any business that waits to accept Bitcoin until there is no other option, because their fiat currency hyperinflates, probably is not going to make it, or at the very least, that business will have a much harder time surviving than had it acted sooner. The decision to invest in Bitcoin payment infrastructure before it is perceived necessary is just that, a perception of necessity. For someone who understands why Bitcoin stores value, it would instead be a logical and rational measure to further insulate a business and one's future from the fragility of the fiat system before it becomes painfully obvious. When did Noah build the ark? Before the rain. And while there may be people or businesses out there that have the ability and power to demand 100% of receipts in Bitcoin, the transition to Bitcoin payments in most cases will just as logically be a gradual shift as the shift to saving in Bitcoin typically is. For example, if a business takes in 2% receipts in Bitcoin and 98% receipts in dollars, or another fiat currency, the business might never have to convert back the dollars. But if the merchant receives too high a percentage of receipts in Bitcoin, it can periodically convert working capital back to dollars as necessary. Just as with saving in Bitcoin, the shift to Bitcoin payments being a gradual and progressive one makes it much more simple than meets the eye. It all starts by a merchant deeming it necessary or prudent to give an option to customers to pay in Bitcoin as a means to de-risk the future and the long term. I could make the case that all businesses should accept Bitcoin as payment. The truth is that it is only true for businesses run by entrepreneurs that first understand that being set up to do so is a balance sheet decision. Why Bitcoin will store value, and the primary incentive is to further de-risk their business from fiat payment rails. Elon Musk is a perfect example. His businesses bought a lot of Bitcoin, and in Tesla's case, even got set up to receive Bitcoin as payment for cars. But it became clear publicly that he did not understand Bitcoin, and later his businesses predictably sold most, if not all, of its Bitcoin in treasury, incurring cost without benefit because the requisite knowledge did not first exist. It is the merchant, rather than consumer, that will drive the shift to Bitcoin payments, but in terms of early adoption, it will logically be those who credibly understand why Bitcoin will store value over time. Without that knowledge, merchants will be disappointed and frustrated, and paying and receiving Bitcoin is otherwise irrational to both the consumer and merchant, if not for the business actually wanting to save in Bitcoin. It's also not all or nothing. It will be a shift. It starts with a merchant being set up with infrastructure and giving consumers the option. Pay me in Bitcoin means investing in the option, not cutting off your nose to spite your face. But being complacent and not investing in the infrastructure until it's obviously necessary might be just as bad, if not worse, in the long run. When will merchants widely adopt Bitcoin payments? When enough merchants understand that Bitcoin is a better form of money. It's that simple. I want to give a tip for anybody who uses the cold card. If you're using it with the Nunchuck wallet, which is kind of like my favorite multi-sig and like key management software to use, the Nunchuck wallet is just awesome. But I use it with my cold card and my tap signers, both from CoinKite, our sponsor. But if you're using it on an iPhone, the NFC reader is very close. So when you turn on NFC in your cold card, just like in settings, you can just tap your phone to it in order to sign any transaction. So you can completely manage your wallet on mobile, on Nunchuck, and then just easily sign by touching it to your cold card. But just so you know, fun little tip, the NFC reader in the cold card is on the number 8 on the middle button. And to work with it really well on the iPhone is just touch like the very top of your phone, like where the speaker is, the little speaker line on your phone, touch that like right to the 8 and it'll just boom. It'll just sign quick and easy. You make a transaction, you hit ready to sign on your cold card, and then you just touch that speaker line right to the number 8 on your cold card and boom, signs, sends. You just made a transaction on mobile, super easy, super fast, crazy secure, and none of your keys were ever exposed to the internet. This is how you Bitcoin as a sovereign individual. And lucky you can get 9% off your cold card at bitcoinaudible.com/cold card. That's just a redirect link. Just remember the discount code BitcoinAudible if you don't use my link, but it's right there in the show notes, so it's really easy to find. Check them out. All right, another great one from Parker Lewis. I really enjoyed his talk at BitBlock Boom, but I have to say he was able to kind of pull out more of the details or more of the specifics in, or maybe I didn't actually get to see his entire talk at BitBlock Boom. I saw the majority of it. I think maybe I was late. But I feel like he was able to pull a bit more out of it in this article, which is why I was kind of interested to read it on the show. But I think he has a really great point here. And one of the things that he brings up that I've talked about a lot on this show before is there's a quote kind of early on. It says, "In my experience, this is not a chicken and egg dilemma as to which comes first," when he's talking about store value versus merchant adoption, all of these things. "There is a logical order. Humans first must reasonably expect a good to store value over some time horizon in order to trade their finitely scarce time, which translates to the output of their labor, in return." So I thought that was a great quote. And one of the things that I talk about a lot, this is why I have always thought that the big blocker, the idea that the payment network side of blockchain technology somehow drives the value of the consensus technology, drives the value of the money itself, I've thought was always backwards. It never made any sense. And if you understand the concept of the blockchain itself, like how insanely inefficient it is, explicitly on purpose, and what it is able to achieve, it starts to make it clear what the actual variation is there, or what the actual trade-off is there for the value that it is intending to provide. And I completely agree that there's not a chicken and egg dilemma, that medium of exchange must come after store value. Just naturally, you must expect, just as he says, you must expect it to store value for some span of time in order to trade your finitely scarce value for it, expecting to get that value back later, even if it's a minute. An analogy I've used in the past on the show is that, you know, if Visa is a huge, fast, works payment network, right? Visa built their payment network on top of the dollar because people wanted the dollar. But all across the world, people want the dollar. The dollar is the best of all the crappy currencies of the world. It is by far the shiniest shit in the cesspool that is fiat currency. So the Visa network didn't come first. They didn't build this massive infrastructure and payment network for something that was valueless in some effort to make it more valuable. Like if you took all of Visa and you directed all of that technology in order to trade in handfuls of dirt, the dirt doesn't suddenly become orders of magnitude more valuable because you've got a payment network. In fact, the only reason anyone would do all of the enormous, the astronomical cost of building a payment network for it is if the dirt was valuable, if the thing you were trying to pay with or receive in payment was valuable. That is a prerequisite, which is why I talk about this in Parker Lewis. I know not only did he pretty much explain it in this article, but I'm pretty sure he's laid it out explicitly in the past, is that the transition is not a chicken and egg. That it is perfectly logical to go, that it must go from store of value to medium of exchange to unit of account, because each one of these things is a has a fundamental prerequisite to the next stage. The medium of exchange is required in order for, excuse me, the medium of exchange requires people to understand or at least think that it is going to store value. Now, at some point, it will become obvious that is the case, but it's kind of like the internet in the 90s. Is that it wasn't self-evident that the internet was an incredibly valuable expense or a cost or investment to make, because it didn't have this, it didn't have its own self-reinforcing, just profoundly valuable network, right? It was prior to the network being robust enough to really keep a lot of these businesses alive. So something like Amazon is actually an enormous risk, because you don't even know if you have the network necessary for people to use that service. And one has to understand that the future value, like, you have to see it, right? The entrepreneur, the Jeff Bezos, has to see, has to understand that the value is going to be the center of world commerce. Otherwise, he would not take that risk. He wouldn't do all of the work in order to set up this idea and execute into the marketplace. Then at some point, the network, the overwhelming success of other participants, the incredible feedback loop, the ongoing development and build out of the infrastructure in order to use this and to utilize it across all of the areas in which it does lower frictions, even in the interim, even in edge cases. And then the incredible capacity, the capital available from savers, from people who have been in the network or been connected to the network for long enough. You, going back to kind of the internet analogy, but in the Bitcoin analogy, people who have been invested and have for long enough stored up their value, their savings in Bitcoin, that just becomes an enormous market for how can we solve their problems in order to now get their Bitcoin. When both Bitcoin eventually reaches that point, and when the internet did reach that point, well, then people began to adopt it simply because of its network power, and the idea that it was going to store value was self-evident. Because they saw the network. They saw that the internet was persisting and growing. So when Bitcoin gets to this point of it just refuses to die, it refuses to die, it will eventually just become self-evident that this is worth investing in. This is worth becoming a part of that ecosystem to utilize both the infrastructure and the network that has been built out for it. That is when we move heavily into the medium of exchange phase. But the other has to come first. You have to realize that it's got a future potential and a strong bearing on storing value. And that's what makes them the early adopters. They see it before it's genuinely true, or before it's not hidden behind volatility and apparent risk. But then you enter the medium of value era. We are still heavily in, we are still going through the curve of the store of value. In fact, the store of value curve actually kind of stretches across all three phases. It's just that the next phase starts before the last phase ends. All three store of value, medium of exchange, unit of account completely overlap. So the medium of exchange phase is when the payment infrastructure and the second layers and the custodians and the pseudo custodians and the federations and the e-caches and the lightning networks, all of these things get built out, this variety of infrastructure and availability begins to allow, easily allow, those who are at the edges of Bitcoin, who are not the incredibly computer literate Bitcoiners, but are the Bitcoiners who understand the argument, who understand the kind of foundational ideas, to basically get directly involved, to get directly connected to it. Because for a long time, it's just been kind of cypherpunk hobbies, right? It's all been really rough code. I think a great example of this are services like Nodeless, Blockstream Green, and the Breeze SDK. Like, that's why I'm excited about these things, is because I think they give people avenues to simplify the acceptance and the integration with these tools without needing all of the infrastructure side. Without, you know, Greenlight runs your node for you. Nodeless just forwards payments. The Breeze SDK has you automatically plug into an LSP, so you can basically just write code into an app, any app that just says receive payment, generate keys, like to just do the commands for Lightning, and you don't have to think about any of it. You're not running a light client on the phone. You're connecting to somebody else's infrastructure, but the user is still holding their keys, so you don't have the custodial or regulatory problem. So it's this massive like simplification of the stack in how you can utilize these things, and it's brilliant. It's just, but this is how you move into the medium of value era. This is the infrastructure required for that to even really kick off. And I'm obviously leaving a ton out. Like, there's multiple service Lightning service providers. It's becoming kind of an interesting, very growing market. There's a lot of different LSP models or LSP brands and stuff that are popping up now. Then you've got like Voltage, that is very similar to Greenlight in the sense that it's running your infrastructure and not holding your keys. and on and on. In fact, there's a really great example of there's a Breeze SDK based project or whatever that they just released an article for, and we're probably going to read it this week. So stay tuned for that one. It's fascinating stuff. But anyway, the thing is, you can never actually have a unit of account until you have the astonishing liquidity and goods and services settlement, direct goods and services settlement in the money during the medium of exchange phase for it to be a unit of account. Essentially, to be a good unit of account, you have to be the largest liquidity network. So the people who say Bitcoin can't be money because it's a bad unit of account are completely reversing causality. It's like saying it can't get hot outside until the thermometer shows us that the temperature has gone up. Being a good unit of account necessitates that you have the highest liquidity in the market. So the argument is simply that Bitcoin being the best money, having the most sound monetary characteristics, over a long enough span of time, it will become the most liquid monetary unit. And then, not only will it be the unit of account, but it will be a vastly better unit of account at that stage than the dollar is, because the dollar is constantly manipulated for staggering percentages of the market liquidity. They just counterfeit trillions and trillions of dollars and dump it into the market. And it's just all nonsense. It's non-economic signal. It's economic dis-signal. It is value misinformation being poured like an avalanche into the market economy. So the dollar's unit of account function is actually extremely poor. There's tons of misinformation that is being calculated into the pricing signals, which means it is going to allocate wealth extremely poorly, which is what we see. It's why we get staggering amounts of inequality that just continues to grow. It's why productivity has increased like 300% since 1971 and compensation has only really doubled. It's because where resources are being directed to are not places in which those resources are being well used. Where these resources actually produce excess value, it's where these resources are actually being net destroyed. And this is specifically happening because our money is lying to us. It's being used as a tool to defraud the economy rather than as a tool to spread for valid information to spread through the economy. So when Bitcoin gets to the place where it is the most liquid market with the highest liquidity in exchange for goods and services, which will happen globally before it happens locally, in the sense that I think one of Bitcoin's most prominent places in the medium of exchange phase is that it won't necessarily be that France or the US has like 80% adoption of Bitcoin, where I think there will be small countries that have enormous adoption, like El Salvador. Argentina looks like it might be on that boat too. You'll see a lot of that happening, but that it will be the most universal currency in the fact that you'll still be able to get in 5% of the market in France, also the 5% of the market in Germany, in Russia, in China, in Japan, in the US, you know, in BRICS nations and in dollar reserve nations, in the euro, in all of the markets, there will be this corner of Bitcoin. And as Parker Lewis argues, I think that will come specifically during this era, during where we are in the store of value slowly creeping into the medium of exchange chapter of this whole thing, is in people who understand the investment today because they grasp why the network will be greater tomorrow. They grasp why the internet protocol, even with less infrastructure, with a smaller network, with fewer connections, with fewer available businesses and these things on it, like just with everything smaller and clearly not directly and practically more valuable in the short to medium term, they understand it as a better platform, as a better functioning protocol for communication that will eventually replace the one that obviously has far and away the greater networks, the greater infrastructure, the better standards, the long adopted incumbents and platforms and everything. But they take the risk and they invest in the infrastructure for the internet because they see where it will be in 10 to 15 years. They know it will store its value. Same as Bitcoin. We are still in a place where merchants will accept it because they get that it's useful to do, or it's useful to have, and it's going to be valuable in the future. Now, there's another quote that I got here. I'll read the next one, but it just kind of reinforces what we were already getting into. It says, but into this logic is the recognition that the fundamental decision to accept Bitcoin as payment for goods and services as a business or contractor is more of a balance sheet decision as an input, i.e. one of savings, than it is a decision about a method of payment. I fully accept that some merchants will accept Bitcoin as a method of payment to more efficiently get back to a fiat currency. But even accepting this, I still maintain that its use as a method of payment cannot be divorced from its ability to store value. And I really agree. I think this is a sound argument. And I think it's what I've seen in my own personal examples, is the people who don't understand it don't stay. You know, like I've tried to get people to accept Bitcoin, and I've even got the guy who cuts my lawn to accept it for a whole span of time. And I told him to just hold on to it and to treat it like savings. Like, don't think of this as, you know, day-to-day capital. So, you know, if you need fiat for bills or something, I'll pay you in fiat. I'll pay you in dollars. But think about your Bitcoin like long-term savings. And I would try to reiterate 5 to 10 years. And it was like a year and a half later, it was like it had plummeted. And he was like, no, I got the hell out of that. I'm never touching any of that stuff ever again. And we still kind of like joke about it and stuff. And like it's not completely gone. I think he got burned. But I was just like, this 5 to 10 years, like, you know, don't let that go in one ear and go out the other. But in a sense, I'm just telling him to do what I say. He doesn't understand why. He doesn't get the bigger picture. And that's probably my fault. And I should have given him maybe the Bitcoin Standard or some audio thing that I thought was going to convince him otherwise. But it's a good example of one of the things that he brings up in this piece a little bit later on, is that they just enter and then they end up leaving. Like, it doesn't, like, getting them to accept it as a merchant and even hold some of it doesn't actually solve the problem. In fact, they could end up just causing more volatility, and like Elon Musk, they end up just leaving later because they never understood why they should have been there in the first place. They just kind of got pushed into it or encouraged and thought, okay, maybe I can make a little bit extra money off the hype from these kids over here, these silly kids doing their digital tokens. All right, there's another quote. It says, I also accept that people gamble or speculate in Bitcoin, simply trying to make more fiat money, and have no idea the fundamental reason to demand Bitcoin is because it's a better form of money. It does not change the fundamental reason why there is a market for Bitcoin in the first place. Two things can be true at the same time. Degenerates and professional investors can gamble on Bitcoin, trying to make more fiat money, while at the same time, it remains true that all long-term demand for Bitcoin derives from its use as money, namely its ability to store value over time and facilitate trade. I thought that was a really great way to put it. This piece in particular, or this place part in particular. Of course, people gamble and speculate, and of course, there will be a lot of people who just want to make more fiat money and have no idea the fundamental reason to demand Bitcoin. But this does not change that the fundamental reason why there is a market for Bitcoin in the first place. Another way to think about that is that the bear market lows are held up by the people who understand that it's a valuable money. The reason there is a floor in this market is for the people who understand the long-term prospect of Bitcoin. All of the speculation, all the gambling happens above that zone. But especially in this phase, when people are still conceptually dealing with the idea of a money independent of the state and the notion that it could have value at all, what you get is a lot of froth. You get a lot of volatility. You get a lot of market uncertainty. You get a lot of people coming in, leaving, then seeing it didn't die, maybe coming back in, dipping their toes back in the water, then a whole nother cycle coming in, getting out, and then realizing maybe it's dumb to get out this time. Maybe it's actually going to stick around this time. It's a long, painful process of beating information and value and new understanding into the human mind. That shit doesn't happen very quickly. So when you see those huge swings in the market, you can think of it like froth on top of a drink, right? Is, you know, $25,000 or so dollars of the Bitcoin price is drink. And then there's froth all the way up to like $70,000. But the good thing is that the glass just keeps slowly filling up. And more people will realize that that's the case, and they won't be distracted by the froth as time continues forward. And understanding the long-term argument or the long-term viability, or just the sheer staying power of Bitcoin and the value that allows or enables is what will lead to its widespread acceptance. And the last thing that I saved here, which I thought was really interesting, and what's funny is I've had this same thought, like reflecting back, I'm like, I've actually had this perspective before. Like, this is kind of a decision process that went through my mind, but I didn't recognize it or I didn't think of its significance at the time, is that, quote, if the merchant wants the Bitcoin and you pay in fiat, that is you shifting the burden of fiat friction onto them, and paying your valued vendors in Bitcoin is the opposite of mutually assured destruction. It's mutually assured survival. I really like that quote. But I love the framing and the kind of, because it's an implicit framing. I think it's the position, or at least it's the position that I took in my mind, is that when someone wants me to pay in Bitcoin, I feel bad if I tell them I have to pay them in fiat, or that I would want to pay them in fiat otherwise. But luckily, I don't really have to do that, and I get to do a lot of my business directly in Bitcoin these days. But I just thought it was interesting to think about the ethical dilemma of refusing of a Bitcoiner refusing to pay a Bitcoiner in Bitcoin if both parties have and are able to do that. And he has another quote on this. It says, "This is what I think about each time I pay my rancher for beef in Bitcoin. I don't do it for the novelty. I do it part out of mutual respect, part out of the value for value ethos, not paying for something in the value, a value in a form of money that I know to be losing its value, and in the long term, most importantly, because I want that guy to be around selling me quality beef." I love that addition to it, because this is also a specific thought that I have had. When I think about the services and the business and the stuff that I use that I really like, my favorite coffee place, the farmer I get my beef from down at the farmer's market, or at least want to get a lot more of my meat from, I talk about Bitcoin every single time, and I try to get him to, and he's definitely got that mindset, right? That the ethos. But what's funny, one of the reasons I talk about it with them a lot and constantly just kind of little piece by piece introduce the idea is because I literally don't want them to go out of business because I like them. And I know here he's just using the generic, the more mainstream view of the term selfish, but I would also recommend listening to quote unquote the virtue of selfishness. This is Ayn Rand's piece, and we did the introduction to it. And actually, I've been meaning for a while to go back and actually read all, I think it's like 17 articles in that book. But it's a really fascinating flipping over of the concept, because right now the concept, and I think kind of purposefully from a philosophical point of view, it conflates selfishness and greed, which are not the same thing. In fact, life is necessarily selfish, but all of the things, all of the community, all of the love, all the altruism, all the being nice to people around you is a selfish act, because it makes us feel better. It gives us more security. It makes us a part of society. It is mutually beneficial. And when you logically break it down, only those things that are mutually beneficial are in the long term for your best interest. I can't remember who it is that said that. I think maybe Rothbard kind of had this position. But it was something I feel like we've read on this show. But it was a really interesting excerpt or section from whatever this piece was. It was talking about how society and the individual are not at odds. Like, there isn't this misalignment of incentives. And it's actually a logical error of people who want short-term gain in exchange for long-term stability. But the individual and society are aligned, because the individual is worth nothing without the society, and the society doesn't exist without protecting the individual. But this is just such a great tiny example of exactly that I want to help protect the place that I go and get coffee, because I want them to stay around. Because I like them. I like being around them. They're a really great place. They're super friendly. They make excellent food. And they do it without seed oils and grains and all of that stuff, just kind of by default. And it's also phenomenal. Therefore, I almost feel this fear that if they don't get onto Bitcoin, there will literally be a day in which they might be horribly struggling, and then I'm going to have to scramble to convince them of something, whereas I can kind of protect them ahead of time, and we can kind of ride the waves together and be like, oh, wow, that's interesting that the fiat side of things is going to shit, but look, Bitcoin's doing really well. And of course, same thing with my farmer. I don't want to have to go find a new network or find somebody else that I can actually have a conversation with and I clearly share values with to get me beef. I want them to survive the storm. So the notion of it being selfish is just like saying that wanting your family to be protected is selfish. Yes, it is, but that's not a negative thing. It's the source of why we care about stuff to begin with. But anyway, I'll link to the Virtue of Selfishness episode because it's a lengthy kind of shifting of the mental frame that doesn't do justice in a few minutes of explanation. It's a really, really great thought experiment, if nothing else. It's healthy for your brain. Go listen to it. But in the notion of Bitcoin becoming a medium of exchange, I think one of the things that we should all do is basically, we need to be adamant about being paid in Bitcoin. We need to make it known that that is our first preferred option, and that we shouldn't necessarily or worry about thinking of the Bitcoin economy as a circular economy. We should think about it just in the context of our individual. Again, localize is that I simply want to have the option to pay in Bitcoin, and I want people to accept in Bitcoin. And for the people that I know who are Bitcoiners and who work or help provide value or can provide value, that I work with them in Bitcoin. And honestly, it's becoming so much easier, and we have so many of the tools now that it's actually increasingly pretty easy to do. There's still a big part of making sure you find all the right tools, but they are out there. But anyway, just a call to action is, if you understand the Bitcoin message, the mission, accept Bitcoin. In whatever you do, accept it. All right. With that, a huge thank you to Parker Lewis for the Pay Me in Bitcoin Theory. I thought this was a really great piece, really great addition to the Gradually Then Suddenly catalog. And I'll have links to Parker Lewis's other stuff. We have so many. If you never read the Gradually Then Suddenly series or any of Parker Lewis's stuff, that's a mistake. You should definitely read them all. I'll have links to the first episode, and you should be able to get to the rest of them for there, right in the show notes. With that, a huge thank you to Nodeless.io and ColdCard for supporting Bitcoin Audible. Don't forget to check both of them out, and don't forget I'll send you 10,000 free sats if you use my link in the show notes, bitcoinaudible.com/nodeless, and set up your donation page and shoot me the link, and 9% off your cold card with code BitcoinAudible. With that, I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. If you want to change the world, start with yourself. Mahatma Gandhi.